Live from KCUR News, this is Casey Currents on Central Standard, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On this week's show, hear what it takes to become a school bus driver.
These are an extension of my grandchildren. I just love every one of them.
Recent accidents have had us wondering how safe school buses are. The answer may surprise you. And one local school district is coming up with some innovative ways to improve the emotional climate on the school bus and make the most of what's usually downtime. Plus, a local children's book author finds a tasty way to address race and identity.
If you were to sit down with a child and say, this is the true story of a boy, then it makes it very real for them.
And we hear what you had to say about rooting for Sporting KC in the upcoming Major League Soccer Championships. It's Casey Currents. Listen up. Just after this news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Welcome to Casey Currents. We use stories and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. And now we're live, so you can call in and share your thoughts on some of the big issues in our community. Nothing terrifies parents like news of a school bus accident. This August, a bus carrying students from the Pembroke Hill School turned on its side as its driver took a highway curve too fast. A video showed the driver didn't have his hands on the wheel. The last big accident in the KC area was in 2005 in Liberty. The driver apparently stepped on the accelerator instead of the brakes, and two other drivers died. In both cases, children were seriously injured, though there were no fatalities among them. Actually, as the industry often points out, there are very few school bus fatalities compared to any other mode of transportation, about 19 a year. Possibly a lot more dangerous is what's happening on the bus. You hear about the bullying that kids endure. Today on Casey Currents, we're stepping onto the school bus to hear about the latest in safety concerns and what one local district is doing to make the ride to school a lot more than just a ride. Call in with your school bus questions or stories at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888, or comment on our Facebook page. The key person on the school bus, of course, is the driver. So to find out more about what it takes to be a school bus driver, I recently met up with one outside Kentucky Trail Elementary School in Belton.
Y'all tell Miss Sylvia what you get on Friday afternoon.
Oh, we get candy on Fridays.
From who?
From Mr. Ernest.
Really? Why'd you start doing that?
I started when I first driving because if they're good all week, then they get a treat. And they're always good.
Mr. Ernest is Ernest Garner. He's 73, retired twice already, but says this is the best job he's ever had. And it's because of the passengers.
These are an extension of my grandchildren. I just love every one of them.
It was 7 years ago that Garner started driving a school bus for Crabtree Transportation, which operates in the Belton School District. He had just moved here from Louisiana in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. There, he'd been a firefighter for 20 years, and then an IT director in a university hospital for another 20. Instead of taking it easy now, he's up before dawn most days, with the school bus parked outside of his house.
I start the bus up early, about 30 minutes before time. Let it warm up, especially on these cold mornings, and then I do a pre-trip. I go around, I check all the tires, I check make sure the bus is level, make all my lights, everything else to make sure that the bus is safe before I ever leave the house.
He's on the road at 6 a.m. to pick up middle and high schoolers. Then Garner does the elementary school round. He says he likes working with all age groups and never has serious discipline problems.
If one of them stands up or gets up, I tell them, call them by name and tell them to sit down and they'll do it.
Garner says he knows all the kids' names, their parents too, and he keeps track of their birthdays. And after they graduate, some of them keep in touch with him. Garner says his job is much more than just driving kids to school.
You know, we as bus drivers, we're the first ones to see those children in the morning time. And it's so important that we call them by name and say good morning and give them a smile because that may be the only smile they get during the day.
Okay, y'all go ahead.
You better get
homework done. Bye, Daddy. Have a good day, baby.
Bye,
baby. You have a good day.
Bye. That was Ernest Garner, a school bus driver for Crabtree Transportation in the Belton School District. Now, Mr. Ernest sounds like a classic school bus driver, but not everything happening on school buses is so classic. One local district is working to, as they say, change the climate on the bus. Administrators have some innovative ideas. Joining us to talk about them are Doug Ward, Student Management School Liaison Coordinator for North Kansas City Public School District, and Kate Place, Principal of Briarcliff Elementary in North Kansas City. Welcome to KC Currents.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, it seems like school buses are one thing about school that hasn't changed in a long time. At least since I was a kid, they look the same. They smell the same. The same shenanigans happen on them, as far as I've heard. Is that true in your experience, Doug?
Sure. I mean, you know, kids are still going to be kids regardless of whether they're on the bus or in the school. You know, we like to think of the school bus as purely an extension of the classroom. And so we tend to want to replicate that on the school bus.
But in classrooms, you think, well, there's digital boards now, you know, kids have computers, all of this, and you just think the school bus is kind of the same. I mean, is it?
It's not. I mean, obviously, it's not the same. The big difference is we have typically, you know, one instructor for, you know, 50 to 60 kids. And fortunately, the difference between a classroom setting and a school bus is that all the kids are sitting behind you. So, you know, a little bit of a disadvantage for the driver. But, you know, the drivers have lots of tools at their disposal. So they...
And we're going to get into, you're sort of starting to think of the bus as possibly being kind of a classroom.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, just to take a step back, North Kansas City runs its own school buses, hires its own drivers, and owns the buses.
Yes.
Is that right? How typical is that in the Kansas City area?
It's pretty typical. There are quite a few contractors in the area, but in the Northland, there are quite a few districts that actually own their own buses.
Do you have a sense of what difference that makes?
You know, I think you have more control of your destiny if you own your own buses. I mean, it seems to make a big difference for us.
And tell me, you just heard that story about Ernest Garner in Belton. Did that ring true? I mean, for sort of what school bus drivers are often like?
You bet. It's, you know, it's very typical, you know, and you know, our school bus drivers, they are truly an extension of their families, and they really, really do see the kids as their own.
And Kate Place, your principal of Briarcliff Elementary, what difference does a driver make in a kid's day and that experience on the bus before they even get to the school?
It makes every difference in the world. It's the first person that the student sees that connects them to school. And when a parent's waiting at the bus stop and that's their connection to school and they see the name of our school district on that bus, that's the first thing they think of how that child's day is going to go. Or when they get off the bus at the end of the day, that's the same reaction they have as how their day went. It has a lot to do with that wave and smile that they get from the driver and the way the driver calls them by name and says, have a good evening or have a great day.
Do you ever hear from drivers about just what's going on the bus, even if it's maybe seemingly minor things?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's a big part of what we do to have a staff member standing at the front door every day and greeting the kids as they're getting off the bus and walking them in. So that's a great place to connect that communication right there. Drivers will share information about what's going on, and we're able to respond to it right there, just like we would in the hallway or in the cafeteria or at recess.
Now, I understand, Doug, that you're working on kind of changing the climate on the bus. What does that mean? Like, what climate are you trying to change?
Well, I tell you, being as though we're trying to make this an extension of the classroom, one of the things that we have incorporated is a program called Books on Buses. And, you know, with the schools, the majority of the schools, their directive for the kids is they want them to read 20 minutes a day. Well, the facts of the matter is that, you know, frankly, the average bus ride for a student is about 20 minutes. So, you know, if the kids would just take that time to get a book and sit down and read, they could be done for the whole rest of the day.
Well, Principal Kate Place, you're experimenting with that. It seems like a big,
you know, demand to ask kids to be reading during that time when they've never really been required to do anything?
You know, it really starts with us, for us, with modeling what it looks like. So we started small in our schools, and we have several fifth graders who work with kindergartners. And those fifth graders sit together with a kindergarten student, and they have their little envelope with their books in it. And one book might be the kindergartner's reading to the fifth grader, and the other is the fifth grader reads to the kindergartner. So when you model what it looks like, it starts it off in a positive way.
And to what extent have you implemented this idea?
At Briarcliff, we've done it right now with just a handful of fifth graders working with a handful of kindergartners on one bus. But we're really excited to be able to launch that book bin process where kids can walk on the bus, grab a book, and start to read as they get on the bus.
No, for me, that was what I did on the school bus anyway. But for a lot of kids, it's probably a big shift. I mean, how is it working?
You know, what's exciting for me is when I get those envelopes in my box. So I have a mailbox and kids put their envelope in it. And that envelope means I need more books. And the kids come to me and say that we want something different. We're ready. So that means it's working. The other piece that's working is when I know the behaviors of some of those kids are improving on the bus.
Hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, the feedback that I was getting from drivers was just incredible. I started this with three other schools because we're kind of piloting just to find out what it is that we need to do and how we need to tweak it. And I got some naysayers from bus drivers because they're feeling like, you know, a little pressure and thinking that maybe they, you know, they just don't have time to deal with this. Well, the response so far has been really, really positive. I give these bins to the bus drivers, and even the naysayers were coming back and wanting refills of books in for their bins. And so they were amazed. They truly were amazed that it was actually, that it actually worked.
What are the drivers being asked to do?
It's really trying to make this thing as simple as possible for everyone involved, including the bus drivers, because, you know, obviously if it's not simple, they probably aren't going to do it. And it's as simple as putting a box of books on a bus, and maybe the driver assigns a responsible student to be the proctor of that box. And that student maybe hands out the books as they're getting on the bus, and, you know, with the idea that the kids are going to read to themselves, read to another student, whatever the case may be. And the neat thing about this program, because our books are donated by private sources, we are okay with the kids taking the books home. We want them, you know, if they want to keep the book, great. Keep the book, take it home, read it, you know, treasure it.
And Cape Place, are they required to read the books, or is it just an option?
It's just an option right now at this time. And the nice thing about it is that, you know, when you sit at the breakfast table and you look at a box of cereal, kids start to read the back of it. People figured out a long time ago that's a great way to get kids to enjoy reading. And the books are the same way. They're going to want to read them because Doug understands, as he's selecting some of those books, that they like to read atlases. They like to read Guinness Book of World Records. They like to read great pictures with good captions. And so I think that's what we can put in there, are things that kids want to read. So it's exciting.
Now, when you do talk about changing the climate, I have to ask about bullying, because it's sort of a national issue. And when people think about bullying, either physical or emotional, they think about the school bus where, mm-hmm. you know, supervision's a little more difficult. As you said, the supervisor of the kids or the person who's watching them is facing the other direction and has this whole other important job, you know, driving the bus. I wonder what experience you've had with bullying on school buses and how this might make a difference.
Mm-hmm. As Doug shared, we certainly have experiences with everyday kid things that aren't okay. And we use positive behavior supports to really model the expected behavior. So we know that if we're talking about what we do expect on the bus, it really does cut down those opportunities for things that we don't expect nor allow or tolerate. We would certainly expect that this will increase the positive behaviors and hopefully eliminate some of those negative behaviors.
And to help look at these things, you know, we on the all of our buses are equipped with cameras, and the cameras are amazing. They are such a great tool for us. So when parents call in and they're complaining, you know, that their child is being bullied, you know, and we really take a strict no tolerance to bullying on the buses. And if we're seeing that on the buses, which obviously if it's happening on the buses, it's probably happening in school too. So, I mean, there is certainly that fold back. But the buses and those cameras, it's a huge tool for us.
How long have you been using them?
I believe about 4 or 5 years.
And you found it's made a big difference?
It's a huge, huge tool for us, truly.
You're listening to Casey Currents on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. We're talking with Doug Ward and Principal Kate Place of the North Kansas City School District about some innovative new programs they're developing on school buses. Later this hour, children's book author Shane Evans talks about his new book, Chocolate Me. But now, what do you hear from your kids about what's happening on school buses? Tell us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can comment on KCUR's Facebook page. Doug, I wonder if you can tell me about the Wi-Fi on the buses. You've installed it in 4 buses, is that right?
Actually, 5 buses.
Why Wi-Fi?
Well, you know, about 2 years ago, we got all the high school students laptops of some sort or fashion, and we felt like that it was just kind of a natural transition to offer Wi-Fi to the laptops, because that's what they're used to having in the schools, because all the schools are equipped with Wi-Fi in the schools. So we did this about last year, early part of last year. We installed these 5 buses, and it has worked out really, really nicely for a whole number of different reasons. For the students that perhaps maybe are on a field trip, it's a great tool for them to be able to multitask, you know, to resource things on the internet that maybe they're going to go visit. Debate team is another great example. You know, if they're traveling for 4 or 5 hours, you know, they could certainly go and do their research en route to their debate tournament.
Get those last hour or two of preparation, you bet, get a little cramming there.
And then on the way back, you know, they can get on their computer on the internet and be able to catch up on any homework that they may have missed not being in school.
And sometimes you've actually used that to also allow kids to attend class, or are you thinking about that?
You bet. We have online courses that we offer through the district, and so for some of the students that go to the Northland Career Center, you know, it takes about 30 minutes to get them up to Northland Career Center and about 30 minutes back. So, you know, that's an hour of instructional time that's lost for them. And what some of these teachers have done is to give these students the opportunity to take an online course, which ironically, you know, is about an hour. So they can be on their computers working this online course while they're en route to the Northland Career Center and on the way back from the Northland Career Center and not lose any instructional time.
Well, I'm sure kids don't mind just being able to browse the internet while they're on the bus, but I'm wondering about, you know, previously this was downtime for kids, just chill out and talk with your friends. Is there some pushback there?
You know, they're only going to do what they are willing to do, certainly, and you know, the kids that are really studious, I guess is a good word for it. They you know, they're going to study, and the kids that are not going to study, obviously they're going to use it as downtime and you know, just talk with one another, and that's certainly the case. But that's, you know, that's going to be a personal choice on their part.
And I have to ask, you know, some people have motion sickness. Kate plays the principal when they read on the bus. Have you encountered that?
We haven't encountered it to this point, but that's that option piece. So if it works for somebody and it's comfortable for them, then it's a great option. But it hasn't been something we've encountered yet.
Not among the elementary or high school students?
No, haven't seen anything. You know, there haven't been any illness, any sickness on the buses in any relation that we've correlated to any of these activities that we're trying to incorporate.
So are there any other programs that you're looking to incorporate into school buses?
These are the main pieces that we're looking at. You know, you got to walk before you run. And you know, at this point, the Books on Buses, we're just getting started on this program, and our goal is for that particular program is to have it district wide by the middle or the end of next school year or thereabouts, to have everybody fully integrated into the system, and we're just really hopeful that that's going to just be a huge benefit for referral sakes and for student literacy sake and just any number of different benefits.
When do you think you might expand it to other schools?
Sometime after the first year. I mean, really, you know, there are some resources that we're needing to get into place, and we're thinking that maybe by spring break, maybe we could have that in place.
Have you heard about other districts doing things like this?
Not necessarily.
How did these ideas come up?
A couple of years ago, well, at the beginning of last year, we implemented balanced literacy model in our district and just really put in a tremendous focus on literacy. So everyone has begun to understand the importance of literacy throughout our building and our day. But understanding that the school bus is truly that extension of the classroom, so why wouldn't we talk about how to increase literacy on the bus?
Then it seems like since you run your own bus program, it's something that's much more easy to implement than if you did not.
You bet. And the nice thing for Kate and other principals like this is it's pretty much a hands off for the schools, because we're pretty much in charge of our own destiny on the buses, because all we have to do, you know, we don't involve the schools in any way, shape or form. These are not library books. These are again, books that have been donated. So, you know, if they happen to disappear, bonus the kids, you know, they get to keep them.
Well, I want to thank our guests for joining us. Doug Ward is Student Management School Liaison Coordinator for North Kansas City Public School District. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Kate Place is Principal of Briarcliff Elementary, also in North Kansas City. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to be talking a little bit more about school bus safety now with Paul Fishbeck. He's at Carnegie Mellon University and studies risk. Professor Fishbeck, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Tell me, how did you get into studying risk on school buses?
I was part of a National Academy of Sciences working group that investigated the various ways kids get to and from school and the risks associated with them.
And so how did you start even looking at that?
Well, there was some concern. I mean, there are a lot of strong advocates for people who are proposing that school bus safety be increased or improved. And so the National Academy got comments from Congress saying, hey, we got a problem here. Let's see how big the problem is.
What year was that?
This goes back about 10 years now.
We want to hear from our listeners. How safe do you feel with your kids on the bus? Call us with your story, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or send an email to kcurrents@kcur.org. So, what did you find? What is the risk of putting your kids on the bus? You know, a lot of us might feel like our kids are safer if we drive them ourselves.
Yeah, there's no question. We have, you know, in addition to the work I did with the National Academies, I've also surveyed lots of parents to find out what they're worried about. And it turns out that parents are concerned about their kids going to and from school, and they feel that it's safer for them to drive. But in fact, it's much, much safer to have the child on a school bus. It's somewhere between 5 and 6 times safer for a child to ride in a school bus than go with a parent.
Why is that?
Well, if you compare a school bus to a vehicle that a family typically drives, the school bus is gigantic. And so in any sort of traffic incident or crash, the school bus is going to dominate whatever it hits. And so the fatality risk in riding in a school bus is much, much lower. And, it's much lower than parents driving, but if you compare it to teenagers driving, it can be like 44 times safer.
Wow.
So it's dramatically, dramatically safer. And also, when you compare it to walking and biking, you see numbers that are, you know, 10, 15, 30 times safer in a school bus than you are walking or biking.
Well, interesting. We have a caller, actually, that was going to talk about walking. Amanda joins us from Midtown. Hi, Amanda. Amanda, are you there? Amanda may have stepped away. She wanted to talk about a walking school bus at Gordon Parks, but I guess in terms of safety, walking is more dangerous?
Well, it just, and once again, it depends on, you know, there are these walking school bus programs that try to really dramatically reduce the risks associated with walking. And in addition, there are these health benefits that accrue because you are getting exercise. And so how you balance all these things out and how do you make the walking or biking transportation mode safer are things that school districts must consider.
Now, how is school bus safety regulated? It's mostly state and local, is that right?
That is correct. There are, and they vary from state to state. And some districts, there are some that that do in fact have seatbelts on school buses. But then the problem becomes how do you get students to use them? And you know, that's a very, very tricky problem. Is the school bus driver responsible for making sure that students are strapped in the back? And that just can't be done.
And, you know, as you say, after every accident, you hear call for seatbelts on school buses. It seems like a no-brainer. What have you found in terms of how effective they are?
Well, the tricky part is that, you know, as was mentioned earlier, that during school transportation hours, going back and forth to school, about 800 children die a year. And of those 800, less than 20 are involved in school bus accidents. So the vast majority, you know, the 780 or 790 children that are killed are doing other modes and much riskier modes. So that anything that you do that reduces the school bus, you know, coverage for a school district will, in fact, increase the risk. So if you make school buses more expensive and then limit what pickup ranges they use, you will, in fact, increase the risk. Things like improving parking lots.
Can you explain that for a minute? You're saying if you make it more expensive by having to purchase all those seatbelts, why does that increase the risk?
Well, it depends on what the school district does. They usually have finite budgets, and so that they may have to cut back a little bit on the school bus service. So we'll pick up fewer kids with the school buses that are safer. And so those other children who used to go on the school bus now will walk or bike or have their parents drive them or drive themselves. And by doing that, you increase the risk.
Have you taken a look at drivers at all and what role they play in the risk or the safety of students?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I mean, if you know, the riskiest category, you know, for getting kids to and from school is having a teenager on a motorcycle. And it is truly off the scale when compared to school buses. But if you look at teenage drivers, it's 44 times riskier to have them drive than to have the teenager on a bus.
Well, I was actually wondering about the bus drivers, school bus drivers.
Oh, the bus driver, yeah. The bus driver, once again, these are regulated at the local or regional level, and the standards vary. There's no question that the driver is the critical component in the sort of the chain or the risks associated with traveling. What programs, what requirements, what experience is required is something that a school district can, in fact, help determine. But then, once again, is what's the availability of school bus drivers, and what are the costs associated with hiring people with greater skills, and what's their availability?
Have there been studies at all on who drives buses and you know how much they get paid and all of that and how that?
Yeah, I am not familiar with studies like that, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were such things out there.
What about having aides on the bus or cameras, as we were just talking about in the North Kansas City School District?
Cameras have been a huge change in what happens on a school bus, and it dramatically reduces the amount of distractions for the driver, in some cases the cameras are in fact just are a fake, and it looks like there's one up in front. You can't tell if it's a real one or a fake one, but even so, having that possibility in front makes the kids behave much better.
And You know, we've been talking about the risk of accidents, but, you know, probably the greater risk is other kids, you know, kids getting bullied either emotionally or physically. Have you looked at that at all?
Yeah, once again, I have not studied that, but the use of the camera, you know, just makes it so much easier to identify when problems are occurring, and you can identify specific, you know, children that are causing the problem. And it allows for intervention, and it reduces the he said, she said kind of arguments that can occur. You have, you know, video proof as to what's going on.
Now, your research shows that school buses are pretty much the safest way for kids to get to school. Are there school bus safety groups that disagree with your research or think it's dangerous because it doesn't push, you know, policymakers to push for seatbelts or other ways to make school buses safer?
Yeah, I mean there are two things. One is to improve school bus safety in and of itself. The other is if you look at the system or all the ways children get to and from school. You know, it's important to remember that school buses are incredibly safe relative to the other modes. And so if you have a high school and you really want to reduce the risk, if you can get 10% of the drivers to ride a school bus, you will do far more than requiring, seatbelts.
Keep going.
No. It's a modal shift. Anything you do to take a kid off a school bus increases the risk.
So the advocates should be pushing for more kids to ride buses.
Well, you know, I mean, that's certainly, you know, to me is a very important step. If your goal is to make school transportation safer, that would be the first step.
Well, Paul Fishbeck, I think that's really interesting research. One thing that I just found in looking into this, I never realized that school buses being yellow is part of the safety features on the bus. Is that true historically?
Oh, yeah. I mean, everything about them, and there are improvements that happen all the time. There was a problem with children being run over by vehicles passing school buses. And so now they have these gates that fold down in front of the bus that actually block the cars from passing. And so, you know, these are steps that are, you know, and the flashing lights, the yellow color, you know, everything that, you know, they keep working on improving the safety around school buses.
Well, Paul Fishbeck is a professor at Carnegie Mellon University who studies risk. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's time now for our Tell KCUR segment. Each week we're asking a question on the air on Twitter and Facebook. You might have heard this week's question. It had to do with Sporting KC, our professional soccer team, competing in Major League Soccer's national championship on Saturday. We asked, how is rooting for Sporting different than rooting for other local teams? And here to talk about the answers we heard from you is KCUR's community engagement reporter, Laura Ziegler. Thanks for stopping by KC Currents, Laura.
You bet, Sylvia. Hi.
Who responded? What kind of response did we get?
Well, we got tons of response, actually. Lots on Twitter, lots on Facebook, and some calls to our callback machine. Mostly fans, so we can't really say that this is a scientific survey.
And what did they say? How is rooting for Sporting KC different than rooting for the Chiefs or the Royals?
Well, we did, I would say, touch a happy nerve. It seems like people really care about this team. They have strong feelings about it. People told us things like they felt connected to the team. A lot of people talked about it being kind of part of, they felt like they were part of a family, that they used words like it was an intimate experience, that it's a tight-knit experience. There's a connection among fans, players, and ownership of the team like no other sports teams, not like the Royals and the Chiefs.
Any sense of what creates that connection?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. First of all, we have some local players. Matt Beasler and Seth Sinovic are from Kansas City, so that's one thing. The ownership is local. This is the only locally owned pro sports team in Kansas City. So people talked a lot about the ownership. They talked about how owners come out into the cauldron and root with the fans, and they drink beer. They talked about how the there's an intimacy in the Sporting Kansas City Park. They talked from Facebook. One person said it was originally different for me because I was rooting for a team with owners that cared about the quality of the play, the fans, and the city. When I root for Sporting, I feel like I'm rooting for a true hometown team. And this from Twitter. It's a responsive ownership. Ownership is much more interactive and willing to engage with me personally. They just don't feel that from the Royals and the Chiefs owners.
Are there different things that people do to root? I mean, I know the Sporting fans wear those scarves.
People talked a lot about the merchandise and that being a part of the fan experience, that connecting everybody together. Another thing is they're electronically connected. One of the big things among the Sporting KC operation was when they built the stadium, they wired it. And that and the internet was going to be a big part of the fan experience. And people commented on that. They said that they tweet a lot, and being part of Sporting KC is a fan experience like no other. Where else other than Sporting KC does the organization consult the fan base on the design of the stadium, the fashion of the merchandise, and provide free road game tickets and communicate with fans before games and during games and after games? So the kind of fact that the stadium is wired turned out to be a really big thing.
Did anyone talk to us that prefers the fan experience for the Chiefs or the Royals or one of the other teams?
Didn't get those folks, but, you know, they might not be predisposed to respond to that question.
Well, they could still comment on Tell KCUR, Twitter, Facebook, or give us a call. Laura Ziegler is KCUR's community engagement reporter. Thanks for joining us.
Go Sporting Kansas City.
You can still comment on Facebook or Twitter about rooting for Sporting KC and other local sports team. The hashtag is TellKCUR. This is a new feature here at KCUR. Stay tuned for next week's question. Coming up after the break, a local children's book author says everybody's got an inner flavor. He is Chocolate Me. This is KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Actor Taye Diggs is known for his roles in the original Broadway production of Rent and the movie How Stella Got Her Groove Back. And although Diggs often plays the hunk on the silver screen, as a kid he was teased for his dark skin and curly hair. He recently told that story in the children's book Chocolate Me, which was co-written and illustrated by his childhood friend, Kansas City artist and author Shane Evans. The book has spun off into an animated series and a documentary, which will show this weekend in a couple of venues. Evans joined KC Currents' Susan Wilson recently to talk about the project and its significance. He started with a reading from his book.
When I came in from outside, I cried. Why? I asked my moms. Why can't I be more like Timmy or Johnny or Mark? With straight hair and a different nose. I suppose my teeth wouldn't seem so bright if my skin were a bit more light, right? Chocolate me. And then my mom said, wait 1 minute, my sweet. Can't you see? You have skin like velvet fudge frosting mixed in a bowl. You can lick the spoon. Cotton candy hair soft to the touch of my fingertips, or braided like rows of corn with a twist. And your smile, she says, makes me so happy I could cry. No amount of money could buy how it makes me feel, for real. It's perfect. Look, she says, look in the mirror and love what you see. Chocolate me.
Shane Evans also had his guitar in hand when he was here at KCUR. He told Susan that before getting the book published, he heard lots of rejections.
Well, there was one interesting comment, because you don't get to hear commentary, but someone said that this book wasn't relevant anymore. You know, there's a, I imagine a committee of people coming into a room and his acquisitions of ideas that hit the table. And, you know, somebody might read Chocolate Me and be like, oh, that's offensive. Somebody might read Chocolate Me and say, oh, that doesn't happen anymore.
Because for the listener, yeah, the book is really about the reactions black children get to their skin color, hair texture, and their African features. And I guess the idea was that, well, people are more accepting of those things now. Do you think that's true?
Well, yes and no. And so then the book also, you know, reflects when you pull those features away, it reflects one child's personal experience. That's the thing that we like to emphasize that this is Tay's true story. And I think when you start a book that way, if you were to sit down with a child and say, this is the true story of a boy, then it makes it very real for them. Then they start to embrace the idea that, wait a minute, if this child got picked on for this reason and I'm getting picked on for this reason, you know, and they make the connection, then the tools that this child used, I can use too. And then that's where we take it into a more universal space.
Because the truth of the matter is, on the playground, kids can be cruel, and there's always a reason to talk about someone else's nose, the way they look, something. So is that what you were getting at?
Yes, and then that's the kind of, again, the universal picture of this book. And then Tay talks about it. He felt like some of the questions that he got were innocent questions, you know, children likely the same age, 7 years old. You know, it's funny, like we were working with a independent filmmaker out of Michigan, and he put together a wonderful piece about chocolate meat, and he was interviewing children. And in the interviewing, he asked this boy, looked like he was about 9. He says, do you know what racism is? And the boy repeats it. He goes, racism? And he goes, and you hear in the background, yes. And the boy goes, no, I don't. So he's 9. You know, that means he has no real understanding of what that word means in relation to who he is. Mm-hmm. And so there again, it's like, you know, but I'm sure if we sat down with that child and was like, do you know what it feels to be, you know, picked on, or do you know what it feels like to be in a position like this? And then I think that's where it all starts to connect.
Because you talk about the innocent questions, and in the book, the little boy is being asked things like, well, does that color on your skin wash off? And you're saying some of those questions are just innocent questions, children confronting differences.
I would say yes. You know, you can always flip the scenario, and that child, if you receive a question in the way that it's given to you, you know, you might be in a position to reciprocate and say, well, I want to know more about your straight hair and how you work with that. You know, then it becomes, there's this idea of it being equal, because it's an equal measure of being curious about, or, you know, just wanting to understand better, you know.
You started illustrating, developing illustrations for the book.
Mm-hmm.
How do you go about creating the face of the chocolate me boy who was really Tay? And how do you begin developing illustrations, particularly since this book has kind of a sensitive topic, illustrations that don't stereotype certain kinds of looks? Seems like that would be tricky for an illustrator.
Well, staying true to what I see is trusting that I'm doing the right thing. I mean, I have to be prayerful and mindful when I'm creating, and offending someone can happen, and we don't even know that we were doing that. Fortunately, you know, I haven't offended anybody that I know of, but it's possible. And so, I draw what I draw what I read sometimes. I draw what I know. I draw what I research. So it comes from a lot of different places. I don't just, you know, sometimes I go from my imagination. That means that I'm not, I can close my eyes, and there are times where I close my eyes and let my hand just do the work. I don't need to look at the page. I can feel it sometimes. So you just got to trust yourself, you know, as an artist. Norman Rockwell, I look at the work that he did creating and recreating the human figure. He did some of the most incredible portraits of, you know, brown people, I guess, you know, if that's what you want to look at the difference. But he was a draftsman. He could have drawn all these people in black and white, you know. So it's these features. You're just recreating them in your media.
You know, you talked about the fact that one of the selling points of the book is this is a personal story. And Tay's painful confrontation of his looks and being questioned or teased about them. But, you know, some people who've watched Stella Got Her Groove Back or The Best Man and consider Tay kind of a sexy guy, they would probably find it ironic that at one time he struggled with the way he looked.
They might. As soon as they got over that irony, they would probably be able to relate to him better as a human.
In the short film, The Chocolamentary.
The Chocolamentary, yes. You said that well.
I practiced that.
Cool, yeah.
You talk about the fact that the book may discuss skin color, but it's not a racial book. Mm-hmm. What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, I think if I was like, hey, what flavor chocolate are you? You know? See, you smiling right now, and it's because what's the answer? What's the answer to it?
Well, my flavor of chocolate is lemon bar.
Lemon bar chocolate.
Lemon chocolate.
Yummy. That sounds amazing. And so,
light caramel chocolate.
Yummy as well, you know. And so right now we're not talking about race. We're talking about caramel chocolate and lemon flavored chocolate. And that puts us in a whole different set of, you know, senses, I guess. That's probably the best way to put it. So that's really like we can take it out of that realm of speaking on race by speaking around it in a different way, speaking like, close your eyes and describe to me what you taste like.
And one of the reasons you want to avoid people thinking this is a book about race is?
Well, here's the thing. We want to address people where they are. We don't want any voids to happen. We don't want anybody to avoid it. We do want to, it's a tool. So if a teacher, I've had some really interesting feedback from teachers. And I put it like this, let's speak in the vernacular of today. A white teacher in a classroom with black students, okay? And this teacher is a teacher. So let's now erase those color barriers and say a teacher is teaching students, all right? We're not talking about color. She needs tools, though, that can serve the students in her room, and she knows this. And so, you know, her perspective on the book was that this was a way for her to open up that dialogue for a better way to teach for her. Like, her heart is as a teacher, not, you know, a white teacher. Like, what is that, you know? And these students are just students. They may not even know what some of these ideas are. But, again, I think if you strip it away and go back to the core message, every child might go, yeah, I remember when, you know, that child over there was picking on me, miss, you know, teacher, and then go from there, you know.
So part of the message of the book that I took away was one of the importance of self-love, whatever yes. flavor, whatever color you are.
Yes.
Why is that so important, especially for African-American kids?
Well, African-American children, it's important to them because they need to love themselves, right? Okay? Now, that's a simple answer, but it's also important to European-American children, Asian-American children, et cetera, to all love themselves. It's really important to everybody. You know, I can say especially to African-Americans, but that would only be because, like, you're going to have to, if you're going to go outside into a society that you might find some hatred coming at you, that you better be strong in love.
So as we've talked about and as everyone knows, you're an illustrator, a visual artist.
Mm-hmm.
But I notice you have kind of a theme song that you do about Chocolate Me. Tell me a little about the song, and then I'm going to ask you to favor us with a rendition.
Sure. I'll give you a sampling, yes. Man, it's you know, for me, like, the chord progression is very hopeful. It's very exploratory, you know. It kind of walks you forward, like each lyric. It's very like catchy, is what they say in the music world. Because when I work it with children, you know, they're immediately like it's one of those musical progressions that allows you into it very slowly. And so then it's also very clear, you know, when I look at this face, I see the sweet inside through my chocolate eyes. It's like that is the beginning. And then, you know, talk a little bit about struggle. But ultimately, you know, you are, you know, self-reflecting. Like every time also we perform it, people got to sing it. You know, like it's not me performing. It's not even about performance. It's more about this lesson. Like everybody, let's come on, like open up your mouth, open up your soul. through this music, and let's get it together. So it's a sing along. It's a sing along.
Sing along.
Yeah. When I look at this face, I see the sweet inside through my chocolate eyes, and I say that I'm chocolate me when I'm not feeling glad, 'cause I'm feeling kinda mad. And I look at myself and I say that I'm chocolate me. Vanilla chocolate, milk chocolate, dark chocolate, blueberry chocolate, I'm chocolate me. Strawberry chocolate, banana chocolate, hazelnut chocolate, raisins and chocolate, I'm chocolate me. I love the sweet inside. I love the sweet inside. When I look at this face, I see the sweet inside through my chocolate eye. I'm chocolate me.
So, Shane Evans, we really appreciate you coming past the studio to give us this interview.
I appreciate being here. Thank you so much.
Shane Evans is a local children's book author and illustrator. He'll discuss his new book, Chocolate Me, co-authored with the actor Taye Diggs, on Saturday at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library, and again on Sunday at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Check our website for more information. That's it for Casey Currents today. Our live broadcast is now every Thursday morning. If you missed part of the show, want to hear it again, or subscribe to the podcast, check out our page at kcur.org. Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter. Our handle is kcurrents. Central Standard is back tomorrow with the movie critics, who will be giving their reviews of recent releases and asking for yours. Up to Date is next with historian Doris Kearns Goodwin discussing Teddy Roosevelt. Today's Casey Currents was produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Alex Smith, and Lori Arbor, with help from Esther Honig, Ross Steinmetz, and Sydney Llewellyn. Theme music is by Approach. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross, and this is KCUR.